This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. When Terry Gilliam first decided to adapt Cervantes' Don Quixote to the screen, he knew the project had a cursed history. Orson Welles had also attempted a film version of the novel, only to have a starring actor die before the film could be completed. But the odds didn't daunt him. As a director, Gilliam has always pushed the limits of the possible. He started out as an animator for Monty Python's Flying Circus and co-directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail. In The New Yorker, Giles Smith writes that Gilliam's work is characterized by a taste for outrageous fantasy, a contempt for conventional behavior, an interest in the curious affinities between people and reptiles, and a distinct liking for dwarves, giants, and men with shaved heads. That's a fairly accurate description of Gilliam's movies, including Brazil, Time Bandits, 12 Monkeys, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, The Fisher King, and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which is often cited as a classic example of a Hollywood fiasco. Its budget doubled during production, and then the film flopped at the box office. Brazil and Baron Munchausen earned Gilliam the reputation in Hollywood of a visionary and a battler of windmills. So it seemed a perfect match that Gilliam would take on Don Quixote, until it all went wrong. How wrong? That's the subject of the new documentary film Lost in La Mancha, produced by Keith Fulton and Luis Pepe, which charts the series of mishaps, acts of God, and outright disasters which plagued the production. Here's a clip. This is Gilliam musing about his passion for Don Quixote.
Quixote struck me more powerfully when I reached middle age, because that's what I thought Quixote was very much about.
He's an older man. He's been through life. It's kind of like a last hurrah. He has one last chance to make the world as interesting as he dreams it to be. Yeah, and I'll be 61 in another couple of months. He's an old man. And I've only done X number of films, and I should have done more with the amount of ideas that are floating in my head.
Terry Gilliam, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi there.
Could you take us back to the beginning of the story? When did the Don Quixote project begin? And was it a film you were always planning to make?
I think it was around 1990 when I decided it was time to try to deal with Quixote. Like most people, I knew the story and had seen Peter O'Toole singing his heart out in the film of, The Man of La Mancha. And Quixote had always been, I suppose, part of my personality or madness all my life, this pursuit of impossible things and unhappiness with the banality of life and the need to try to make it more exotic and more interesting. And so it was around 1990, I said, it's time to do Quixote. And I called Jake Eberts, who had been the executive producer on Baron Munchausen, and said, Jake, I've got two names for you. I need $20 million. And I said, one name is Gilliam and the other is Quixote. And he says, done. And then I had to sit down and read the book because lazily I had never bothered to read it. And the copy I had was sort of an old late 19th century copy, so it weighed several tons. And it took me several weeks to get through it. And I realized how foolish I had been thinking that I could make a film of this book because it's such an extraordinary, vast canvas. And nevertheless, I set out. That was a long time ago.
Can you give us a sense, before we start talking about some of the things that went wrong, about how you envisioned the film visually? Tell us some of the visual elements and how you were going to bring Don Quixote's hallucinations, his dreams, to life.
When I deal with fantasies, I tend to do them very straightforward. I mean, I'm looking at the world through the eyes of the madman, so when you're doing that, you're not seeing things with sort of strange colors around the edges and weird out-of-focus stuff. You see it as real. So that's the way I tend to approach it. So when he sees windmills as giants, they're giants. And it's only when we step back and look at it from somebody else's point of view that we realize what they are. So I try to drag the audience in, I suppose, to be Quixote, even though the audience is supposed to be following this other character. And in fact, what happens in the story is that the other character begins to see the world like Quixote does. So I've never dealt with fantasy other than what I thought was in a totally naturalistic or realistic way.
So you worked on this film, Quixote, for 10 years, and you went through two producers. You tried to start the film twice, and this is all before the attempt portrayed in the Lost in La Mancha documentary. But finally, you pulled together a production team And these are people from all over Europe. At this point, you have no Hollywood backing. That's fallen mm-hmm. through. And this whole...
No, to be accurate, it hadn't fallen through. We never asked for a penny from Hollywood. That was part of the job I was doing. I was determined to show that we could make big, spectacular international films without any help from Hollywood in any possible way. That, in fact, it's one of the most disappointing things about the film collapsing is that we failed in that attempt because the current financial situation is such that that's not going to be possible in the future.
Well, let me correct myself. You pulled together a production team from all over Europe. You had no Hollywood backing. And you all assembled in Madrid for pre-production. How did things go at that point? For instance, and I'm thinking that many of the production staff didn't speak much English. How much of a problem was that? Just simple communication. Because you're struggling to communicate your ideas, your very personal, specific ideas with costumers and puppeteers and set designers. It can get very, very complicated.
Not really, because there's an advantage. I mean, I draw. So that is the way one can communicate. And yeah, it isn't quite as efficient, possibly, as if everybody spoke perfect English. In fact, the disturbing moments are when you... Because people are speaking English, you're thinking they're understanding everything you're saying. In fact, they're only understanding 90% of what you're saying. And that 10% can provide some interesting problems. But no, that wasn't really the problem. We can get around those things. You know, I may need to shout a bit louder, but I can always draw something. Or I do it physically. I grab something and say, it should be this way, and boom, boom, boom.
Well, one problem you had, your stars, Johnny Depp, who played Sancho Panza, and the French actor Jean Rochefort, who plays Don Quixote, they don't show up for pre-production costume fittings or rehearsal. In fact, I think at one point in the film, it seems as if you can't get Johnny Depp on the phone at all.
Correct.
That must have been disconcerting. How worried were you?
No, I wasn't. I'm not worried about Johnny, and I wasn't worried about Jean either, to be honest. I mean, because the one thing, having worked with Johnny, I know this is a guy who can turn up 5 minutes before you start shooting, and it'll be amazing. That doesn't worry me. It gets frustrating because there's always things you want to talk about, and you start tearing your hair out because you can't. And Johnny was busy doing the film From Hell, and he was in Prague, so he was under the gun because they were running late. And I was worried that he wasn't going to get there in time. And in fact, he was so exhausted, he did take a week off before he finally got down there. But the fact is, he was ready. But with Jean, because he had achieved a hernia in about a month before he started shooting. And what the result of that was that it was starting to press on his prostate, and the prostate became infected. And what was shocking is when he did turn up, because he did not get on a plane and then he got down there, was that I suddenly was dealing with a man that was about 20 years older than I'd last seen him a month earlier. It was quite extraordinary because he's 70 years old. He raises show jumping horses. A man has never lost a day of shooting in his life. He's far more fit than I would ever hope to be. And this nasty little organ became infected, and he literally went from what seemed like a 50-year-old man to a 90-year-old man almost overnight.
He did show up for filming. You began filming the movie, and the first day of shooting, the trouble seemed to begin. What went wrong right from the start?
Well, there was a little problem about the extras not being rehearsed in a particular fight sequence. That was the moment I went berserk, because, again... What happened? It's a problem in films, because especially on something like this, I was working with some people I hadn't worked with before, so you're relying on other people's knowledge of them. And there are always some people on the film that spend most of their time trying to impress the director by being incredibly charming, rather than going out and doing the hard graft work. And I stumbled on one of those people, unfortunately. And something hadn't been done. Rehearsal hadn't taken place. We're out in the middle of this hot desert area with always limited amount of time, and nobody's prepared themselves properly for that moment. And that was a huge shock. I mean, I did go crazy because it was something I didn't expect.
I think the words you use are, you need to tell me if I'm going to be expletive deleted beforehand. I need to know if I'm...
If I am, I want to know in advance.
That's right.
All I ask. And that's, I mean, it's very funny because I think the four-letter F word I use more than, a thousand times in the documentary. I think I was quite amazed at how limited my dialogue had become.
The second day of filming was the real disaster, though. Yeah. In the documentary, it looks as if a hurricane blew in while you were shooting on location in the Spanish desert. It really looks like a storm of biblical proportions.
No, it was.
What was it like on the set?
I was exhilarated, frankly. Because suddenly, a lot of my concerns about our production problems and potential future problems had all been taken away from me by this hand of this rather violent God. It was quite extraordinary the way it built, because it was a slow build, and we thought, oh, there's some clouds coming, oh, there's a little problem. And when it hit, it was literally like the beginning of Wizard of Oz. And in fact, I'm running around trying to decide whether I'm in the Wizard of Oz or if I'm playing King Lear in The Tempest, in the storm. It was quite extraordinary, because we were under this marquee and all the equipment was there, all the people were there, and I just walked out into the storm. I was so crazed at that point, howling, and I found a large overhanging rock, which I crouched under, as this storm started building, and it got bigger and more spectacular. It was absolutely beautiful in its anger, I think. And little by little, I started watching water pouring down these mountainsides, which were dry, and suddenly there became waterfalls, and then there was a rush of water, and then hailstones started crashing down, and eventually, after about 45 minutes, it ended. And I had been under this rock looking away from the set, and I crawl out from under my rock and look back, and there's nothing there. A sea of mud is all that's left.
It looks like flowing rivers, and they're carrying off your equipment in the flash flooding.
I mean, it literally was a flash flood. It was just taking everything away. And people, what was the funniest thing about it was Lou and Keith, the documentary filmmakers, the ones, they had only one camera, and what they did was run into their car and protecting their camera. They weren't actually filming the stuff. It was, in fact, the stunt coordinator with his digital camera, his own home camera, was filming the things. They were in the car. You'll see it in the film, shot through a windscreen as the hailstones are descending and all. It's them protecting their one piece of equipment.
You did regroup and began filming again. And I suppose this is when the most ironic misfortune happened, something that truly elevates this La Mancha story to a fiasco. And that's that your star, Jean Rochefort, fell ill, and he couldn't ride a horse. Now, we have a clip from the movie. It's from the day of shooting that you realize Rochefort is too ill to ride. Let's listen. And here you've just filmed a take and noticed something is wrong, and you're on the set talking to your first director, Phil.
Cut! Did you see him sit on the horse?
Crazy.
The pain when he sat down.
Act. Yep. He can't do it. It's just, it ain't going to happen.
And I was watching his face very carefully when he got on that horse. And it was just...
He can't ride like that. He certainly can't act like that. And he certainly can't jiggle hand props with that. I want to go to the French and say I'm going to refuse to shoot with Jean Rochefort on a horse until he's medically fit.
That's a scene from the new documentary Lost in La Mancha about my guest Terry Gilliam's failed attempt to adapt Don Quixote to the screen. So here you have a Don Quixote who can't ride a horse. Did you know at that point just how physically impaired Rochefort was?
I think we did, because the irony was that when I had been hunting for a Don Quixote who had to look a certain way, be a certain height, and a certain age, always the problem was that you could find an actor who looked right but couldn't ride a horse. It was the one thing that Jean was absolutely expert at. He was a brilliant horseman. So on that day when he was on that horse and you realized, looked in his face, and you saw the pain he was in, we knew we were in trouble. I mean, I didn't know how bad the trouble was, because we broke for lunch. And Phil Patterson, the first assistant director, said, I'm not going to let you put him back on a horse. I mean, the man's in real trouble. And I said, well, no. We better talk to Jean. And Jean said, listen, I've been here all week. I've been able to do nothing. I don't think I'll be able to get through the weekend unless I'm able to do a scene. I've spent 7-8 months learning English to do this, and I'm going to do it. And then the producers had said, yo, he must go back on his horse. And then talked to Johnny Depp and said, what do you think, Johnny? And Johnny said, well, if he really wants to do it, I mean, you can't say no. And I said, he's an adult. So we put him back on the horse. And all we did, he was on the horse for about 45 minutes, just walking. And at the end of it, it took two people to lift him off the horse, and he was in bed, and he was on the plane the next day to Paris. It's that thing with actors, and that's why I love them, but they can almost kill themselves in trying to do their work. And Jean almost did that.
Rochefort left after that day's shooting, and he promised to return in 2 days. He was seeing doctors in Paris, but 2 days became four, and then 10, and then I guess maybe never. what was going on while you waited in limbo to find out your star's prognosis? Were producers coming to you saying, why can't we recast? Find a different Quixote. Bruce Willis.
There was all of that going on. The insurance company in particular said, recast. And I said, well, we spent almost a year trying to get to this point. How do you just suddenly recast? Because there aren't many people out there that fill the bill. And I said, we've also got very complicated schedule problems. To reschedule is going to be very difficult and costly. And because we were, an independent production, there was no fat in the budget. And I said, I don't know how we can do all of that. Johnny felt very strongly, as indeed did a lot of the cast and the crew, that let's wait for Jean. Maybe it'll only be a month. Maybe it'll be two months. We'll all go away. We won't charge any money for waiting. And when he's well, we'll come back and continue the film. And I was on that side. That's what I wanted to do. But we were given a deadline to come up with an answer, either recast or reschedule or whatever, or they'd pull the plug, and I just felt we couldn't in the time put it together in a new form, and so they pulled the plug.
At some point in the documentary, you're on the phone and you're explaining to someone that you just lost all sense of what the film was, that you had the whole film in your head, you carried these images around in your head, this vision of it all, for a decade, and it's just dribbled out of you.
Well, I think it becomes such a, I don't know, maybe it's a way of surviving. Maybe my system just shut down and sort of closed the door on it. Maybe that's what it was, because having spent, you're torn, because on one hand, you spend so long at it, you're tired of it, you hate it, and you're worn out with it. On the other hand, you just want to get it up on the screen. And so your system is doing bizarre things. And I think physically I was so exhausted, and then you had the emotional exhaustion on top. It was kind of like, on one level, there was a relief. The nightmare is over. I can go back to some other kind of life. And you think you've got over it, and then it would hit you like a month later. What a complete and utter waste of years of your life this has been. And it comes and goes. It's why I am still going to make the film, because the only way I can deal with these problems is to convince myself that, yes, we will do it, and we'll do it in a year or two.
So do other people say you're insane, you should just drop it? Like your wife? People who care about you?
There are those. And anybody in films say, of course you have to move on. That was unfortunate. You probably learned a thing or two. Move on. And I said, no. I mean, mainly because it's the best script I've ever been involved with, I think. I think it's a great script. It took us a long time, and I think we finally got it. And it's just, I just know how good a film it'll be. So that's the problem. I mean, it may be stupid to try to do it, because there's another side of me that says, well, look at the Lost in La Mancha. The documentary shows you a few moments from what the film would have been, and maybe it's better to leave everybody's imagination working. They'll probably imagine a better film than we ultimately make. So there's a side of me that thinks like that as well. But now I've got to do it just because I said I was going to do it, and because it's very stupid and impractical and obsessive and something a grown man should walk away from. That's why I must do it.
Well, it's interesting, because you've had in your career a lot of battles with Hollywood studios. In Brazil, there was a famous battle between you and MCA Universal, in which at the end they wanted you to edit the film, make it shorter, and make a happier ending, and they wouldn't release the film when you wouldn't agree to do that, and you took out this full-page ad in Variety addressed to the president of MCA Universal, Sid Sheinberg. And in the end, you won that battle, but it was a real, you went up against a huge bureaucracy. But in this case, you were working in the way that you want to work. There's no real bureaucratic evil.
No. I'm just the victim of a little infection. A virus got me this time. That's what's so bizarre about it. There's I can't really blame anybody except for Jean getting this infection, which disabled him, and then everything fell apart. It is that problem of working where you have no fat, where you've got no safety net, and that's what we were doing. So when it went bad, it went totally bad. If you're working with a studio, there's a lot of fat around the place, so, you know, these films get made. I think the result of the whole thing, and that's what was happening when it was all falling apart, I kept telling Keith and Lou as they were shooting to keep shooting, is at least, you know, they will get a film out of this whole mess, even though I don't, and there'll be some record of it.
Now, let's talk about the filming of this fiasco, because it's an interesting thing. I was trying to figure out why you would have anyone document the making of your film, given that, for instance, Baron von Munchausen was a very painful experience for you. Your budget seemed to spiral out of control or to double in the making of it, and some in the industry point to it as an example of a director out of control, a movie that didn't do well in the box office. I know there are a lot of ways to interpret that.
That's the one that Hollywood loves,
right,
that version.
Right. But I, it occurred to me that maybe you wanted people to a documentary team on the set of your film in order to provide a record to prove that you aren't a director out of control, that there is a method to your madness. But then the series of unforeseeable disasters happens.
No, I mean, I wasn't approaching it that way. I just know that every time I make a film, something interesting happens, is all I know. And I always regret the fact that, you know, it's not been documented, that somebody wasn't there to record it. And there's another side that, I mean, a kind of selfish, vain side, is just trying to see, to have my own, you know, diary of what went on there, at least, or somebody else's diary that shows what was going on. And it was as simple as that. And Keith and Lou had made a documentary about 12 Monkeys called The Hamster Factor, and it was a wonderful bit of work. And they had been graduate film students at Temple University in Philadelphia, and basically we just gave them a Hi-8 camera and said, shoot, here's lots of tape, you've got access to everything. I wore a microphone the whole time, and I said, it's your film, I'm not going to interfere with it, I'm not going to censor it. So they made a wonderful film then, so I trusted them, and when I said, come out to Quixote Country and see what happens, they were game. And once they're there, as far as I'm concerned, they have complete freedom, complete access. I'm so desperate for the truth that's what I want to see, and I don't, especially in films and show business, everything's about image, everything's about illusion. Nobody ever sees the truth of things. And for me, I just want that to happen. So as everything was coming apart, they were sometimes incredibly apologetic and actually turning their camera off in certain situations because they felt there was too much, you know, pain and anguish around the place, and they felt embarrassed recording. And I said, no, you've got to keep shooting. This is the truth. This is honest. This is the reality of the thing. And I think you'll get an amazing film out of it. And I think that's what's happened. I think when people see Lost in La Mancha, people can say, oh, how terrible, how painful, how awful that was. And I said, well, no, the reality is most filmmaking is more like this than what you see in all the press kits. It's a rough business, and people never get to see that side of it.
What occurs to you when you watch the documentary?
What occurs to me that I should never watch it again is what occurs to me.
Did you watch it?
Yes, I've watched it several times and I can't stand it. It leaves me depressed for a couple of weeks, and I'm trying to get my life back.
After the La Mancha debacle, you auditioned to direct J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter film. That's one of the things you did in the wake of the Don Quixote mess for Warner Brothers. How does a director's audition work? What's the protocol?
It wasn't actually that I auditioned. What happened was that it turned out J.K. Rowling and the producer wanted me to direct it. The likelihood of me directing it was very slim, I think non-existent. And I have a feeling that Warner Brothers brought me out to Hollywood just to show them that they were doing their due diligence and giving everybody a fair chance. And it was a very interesting experience because because I know when I went into the meeting that the majority of people were against me. And by the end of the meeting, I'd actually won over quite a few people that were against me. And I was so angry with myself for getting excited about the project, knowing I would never get it.
For caring.
I ended up driving around for hours later, just kicking myself. For a moment, I allowed myself to really fall into that world and begin to imagine it and think that, yeah, I could do this. And that kind of feeling, when you're not going to ever get the job, when you know that, is very, very irritating, to say the least. And on it went. So the film was made as it was, and it's a huge success. And they obviously made the right choice in director.
What do you think of the film?
Crap.
Really?
I think the film is very badly directed. I think it's uninspired, unfortunately. I can be quite honest about it. I think the first Harry Potter just was very, very disappointing. It was very pedestrian. There was no real magic in it. It was by the numbers. And Lord of the Rings is a wonderful film in comparison. That's what I think. Well, but the box office, does it agree with me? I don't know.
What do you think the distinction is, though, in the way that they create these visions? Because I'm thinking that they're two very, very different styles. And Lord of the Rings seems to have more of a dark and yet childlike imagination to it.
I'm totally impressed with Peter Jackson. I think he actually believes that world. I think he's a very good director. Let's begin with that. He's an excellent director. He threw himself so passionately into that world. He understands it. He understands magic, heroism, epic, the whole thing. It just feel it's in his bones, and so it spews out onto the screen, and it's totally believable. I was, the film was whatever, 3 hours long, that first one, and I sat there, and I was just transported into this other world. I never felt that for one moment with Harry Potter. I thought it's sort of by the numbers. There's some, technically brilliant stuff in it, but there's no magic. There's no real, immersion into that world.
This film does function as a kind of diary of your worst moments as a filmmaker. So it must be very painful to have that that part of your career exposed to millions of people, millions of your potential people in your audience.
No, I don't know. I'm beginning to think failure is a really important part of life and should be given more time on the air. I think everything is so positive now. Everything is so uplifting. Everything's blah, blah, blah. The reality of life is it's very up and down. So it doesn't bother me. I think what's been most interesting is that people come away saying that I'm not a madman, that I'm not out of control, that I do know what I'm doing, and my people like my agents in Hollywood say, oh, this is going to be so good, so useful for the executives to see what a responsible and decent human being I really am, as opposed to the monster they fear.
Terry Gilliam, it was such a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Terry Gilliam. The new IFC film, Lost in La Mancha, documents Gilliam's failed attempt at adapting Don Quixote for the screen. When we spoke, Gilliam was in negotiations with the insurance company to get back the rights to his script, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.